2016, and the last time I was at one of these workshops was 2015, which is now almost 4 years ago. And so it's been very nice to reconnect with some of you, and also meet new participants. So anyway, this talk is about fitting C11 functions to data. I hope it is a nice complement to an algorithmic complement to, say, Monday afternoon's talk. In addition to sort of building on some of the morning sessions. And so this is based upon primarily two papers, one with Errol Glass and Frederick McCollum, who actually were undergraduate students when they started working on this problem with me, and the other with Hari and two of his students, Adam Christofsen and and Jason, who I guess.
Also in Washington,
but I'm a student. Yes, okay, great. So basically, this is work coming out of Harvey's group, previously of Washington, and, but they're kind enough to let me put my name on the paper. And so, as you notice, I like to use little B for the dimension, but in the spirit of So there's going to be three main points to the talk. At the beginning, I just want to give an overview of sort of how I've been thinking about this problem, maybe in the last 4 years, if that's been sort of absent, which is sort of in the context of supervised machine learning, and in particular, regression. As we'll see, though, then this will lead us into two different types of problems, which are related. One is the interpolation problem, which is going to be a big familiar audience based upon this week. And then the other is going to be a regression problem, which maybe is a little bit more unfamiliar, and which will also incorporate ideas when it comes to statistical learning theory. And we'll see that the regression problem, in fact, uses the solution to the interpolation problem, which is nice. So what is the sort of general type of setup we're going to be looking at? We're going to have data consisting of points E, capital N of them and R little n. And generically, we're going to sort of think about having associated values yi, which could come from some function little f defined on E, but which may also be corrupted by some Boy's function epsilon of xi. Okay? And we'll make this more precise. Then we're going to have some functional class calligraphic f with some norm or subnorm associated to it. And so sort of a standard quantity that appears in statistical learning theory, as well as machine learning, is something called the empirical risk associated to a function capital F or a functional class F, which in this case is just a squared loss risk, which basically measures the deviation of F evaluated at the xi's from the values yi that we measure. Okay? And averaged over. And so then there's an associated, what's called regularized regression problem, in which you want to find the function f in your functional class that best fits the data that you're given, that is the points xi and values yi, subject to some type of complexity or, say, smoothness penalty. Okay? So in other words, you're looking for the argon theorem over the empirical risk, but subject to this penalty, or subject to, in this case, this constraint on the norm of the function f, right? So in other words, it has to have a certain level of smoothness for us to accept it. And so this is often done because, of course, if you have noise, you may not want to fit the data exactly, right? You may want to sort of fit the underlying pattern that generated the data, which is a little f, and sort of this noise associated to the measurements. Okay? And so this regularization or this sort of restriction of the functional class is one way to do this. But of course, this also contains, as a special case, interpolation. Namely, if we take epsilon to be 0, and we take m large enough, then, of course, we may be able to find a function which matches the values of yi exactly, which in that case will respond to just the values of xi. Okay. So interpolation is sort of a special example for this. So, as you can see, there are sort of many different possibilities for the functional class F, right? And this is sort of often chosen in accordance with something you know about the problem, or some other considerations which may be inherently prime. So in this conference, of course, you might be tempted to take something like CM of Rn, or CM alpha of Rn, or WMP of Rn. In fact, this talk will be mostly about CM of Rn. But in the machine learning and statistical learning communities, of course, other functional classes are studied at length, actually, in fact, much more at length than these ones. As I said, there's sort of various reasons for that. But of course, one of them is practical. If they actually want to compute things on sort of large volumes of data, which is potentially very high dimensional. And so they've developed certain functional classes that allow them to do this. Many of them are also motivated by the idea that the data does indeed have some underlying structure to it, which is not the necessary to use a conference, but nevertheless, I think it's instructive to give a bit of a flavor. So one of the simplest is a linear regression model, right? You just take your bump, which really means affine. And so you take your functional class to be affine functions of the form x dot beta, where beta is some vector in Rn, plus then a beta dot, which is the scalar term, which sort of allows you to move away from the origin, right? And this is very useful when your dimensional n is quite large. You can still fit quite easily a linear regression model with a squared loss penalty. And there's sort of various regularizations that you might take, what sort of norms that you might put on this, or semi-norms that you might put on this functional class. One corresponds to something called ridge regression, which then penalizes the L2 norm of this vector beta. The other is called lasso, which is when you penalize the L1 norm of this vector beta. Both of these sort of limit the complexity of the model as it moves over the number of dimensions in your data set. The L2 norm here sort of says that all different dimensions can play a role, but only a few can play a large role. And the L1 penalty says, well, actually, only a few dimensions can play a role. Okay. This is, of course, fundamentally for fitting linear affine models to your data set. Right? Of course, you might want something nonlinear. And indeed, one way would be to sort of use polynomials of higher order instead of first order. In some sense, we've already regularized the problem by suggesting that the sort of first-order polynomial is enough. You could go to higher-order polynomials. But there's also other functional classes that do this as well, including nonlinearities. One is where we take our functional class to the Hilbert space and call it reproducing kernel Hilbert space, which is associated with some kernel K, in which the space consists of functions on Rn that are in the span of Kx as x goes over. And we choose the inner product on each to have this reproducing property. And this sort of implies some things about the kernels. This is nice in the machine learning community because it implies a sort of map from your data into this reproducing kernel Hilbert space, which can often sort of map the data non-linearly into a much higher dimensional space, which is easier to sort of linearly separate things. More recently, but also sort of that's sort of becoming in vogue once again after sort of languishing for a while, is neural networks. So neural networks are some functional class which consists of functions of the form of an alternating cascade of affine maps AK and nonlinear maps sigma K. Okay. And generally speaking, you fix the sigma Ks, that is to say the nonlinear components, and you sort of train your model over this empirical risk to learn the different affine functions. Okay, so here's sort of a picture of that. And again, this is sort of a nonlinear model for your data. So kernels, neural networks, higher order polynomials, all of these things are ways of getting these sort of nonlinear patterns in your data. They all sort of encode smoothness indirectly, but maybe not directly, right? Kernels might include a certain type of smoothness, that sort of depends on the choice of kernel. The neural network, of course, has some type of smoothness associated. Layers and the width, that types of nonlinearities, but it's not quite so dramatic. And so, of course, we might want to encode the smoothness of our functional class directly. The simplest, perhaps, choice would be Lipschitz functions, right? So, of course, those people here are familiar with Lipschitz functions. In fact, there has been some work in machine learning on this functional class. subject of today is going to be CMAMA. So functions with functions. So there's sort of a host of reasons, I suppose, one might want to do this, but basically if you want to encode the smoothness in your model correctly, I think, you know, problems coming from physics in particular might be a scenario in which this is particularly relevant. This is sort of a functional class we might want to choose, and of course any of the other choices in here. Okay, so now we're going to look more specifically at the C11 regression problem. So this is if we want to find a function f in C11 of Rn that best fits the beta subject to a smoothness penalty, and the smoothness penalty we're going to pick, or sort of the restriction of the functional class we're going to pick, is purely based on the Lipschitz constant of the gradient of f. And so we're going to consider two scenarios: interpolation, in which we have voiceless data. We would like our values to fit the specified values exactly. And then we'll look at the noisy data and regression. Okay, so interpolation. So the setup for this, this section is going to be fun. We have our data points xi. We have capital N of them. We have the function values associated to them, which we denote by f of xi, or sometimes y of them. We have then the C11 of Rn interpolation problem, which is to say we want to find the function f in C11 of Rn that fits these function values only perfectly. It has minimal semicolons. So that is to say, capital F, which is defined on all of Rn, should match the specified function values of the different xi's. We want to make the Lipschitz constant of the gradient of F as small as possible. So here's sort of the cartoon picture we have in mind. We have data in R2, we have function values associated to that data, which would be determined by the different folders. So as we've heard, though, in some of the previous lectures, there is a related problem to this, which is in some sense a bit simpler, which is when you also have the gradients in this case specified as well by your data. And so in this case, we have points E, again, N of them, function values as well. But we're also given a gradient map from E into Rn. Okay. So actually, I say sometimes we'll denote this by ZI, but in fact, we never will. And so in this case, we have some additional data with which to work. Right? The cartoon picture we have in the back of our mind is now these points in R2 of different colors for different function values, but also with associated arrows, which and so this, and then the interpolation problem is the following: find the function f in C11 of Rn that fits all the given data, that is the function values and the gradients, perfectly, and again has given so the function should fit the function values, the gradients of the function should fit the specified vectors in each point xi, and again, we want to minimize the Lipschitz constant of the gradient of f. And this is easier because more information is specified for us, there's less sort of candidate functions to look over to find the best one. And so we'll see how that sort of goes in this particular case. Okay, so in either case, though, we're going to need to answer some fundamental questions, which in fact we've seen some of the answers already. One is, of course, how small can we make the Lipschitz constant of the gradient of f? And then associated to that is that once we know how small we can make it, how are we actually going to compute that, say, on the right? Then secondly, once we say no at the optimal value of the Lipschitz constant of the gradient of f is, or if we have some value which is close to the optimal value, how are we going to compute then interpolating the function f in C11 of Rn with this feasible value of the Lipschitz constant of the gradient of f? And so the following is going to be a roadmap which shows outlined basically Monday afternoon. So we're going to use the work of Pierre to help answer number one, the work of Wells to help answer number two, and then we're going to use as well the well separated pair decomposition out in the previous talks in the morning. And tools from computational geometry, some of which we've been talking about, to help with the computations. Okay, so let me start with the first question, even though it's review. So how small can we make the Lipschitz constant of the gradient of f? For the interpolation problem with the gradient, say, so the cartoon picture again is the one with. So we have this theorem of Erwin Legendre from 2009, capital N points E, the function values associated to those points, and the gradients associated to those points. This is value P of 1, which is given by this formula here, in terms of two other functions, A and E, which are given here. And so the way to think, one way to think about these functions, A and B, is basically as analogs to sort of the Wigley conditions that we've seen before. But sort of slightly manipulated here to be the exact as possible, small as possible. Okay. And so we'll notice, though, from a computational perspective, right, that A and B, and hence BML1, are easily computable just from our B and E, our function values F, and the gradient, the specified gradient. So anyway, with that in hand, then let's try to compute BML. So the next question then is how we compute BML1. Here is the formula, right? We have to basically look over all possible pairs, xi and xj, of which there are capital N, evaluate A of xi xj squared plus B of xi xj squared, add in xi A and xi xj. And so of course we immediately see that there's an easy and with that in the question mark here, answer, which is a direct computation, right? You simply evaluate this function for all pairs of points. They're on the order of n squared of them, and then there's a constant here depending only on the dimension. And I put the question mark here because the constant actually indicates quite nicely. It's linear in the dimension, right? And so this algorithm actually is, in fact, not always bad. It's, in fact, quite good. If your dimension is proportional to the number of points, right? Especially in light of the associated points. and so actually this is, I don't want to like sort of sidetrack my talk on this, but this is actually a very common case of machine learning. It's very common, it is very high dimensional, and that the number of points you have is proportional to the dimension. And in fact, it's basically, there's a whole sort of theory of high-dimensional statistics associated to this as well. And it leads to a lot of interesting problems, in large part because sort of traditional statistical methods break down, including things like the law of large numbers and so on and so forth. But anyway, this is maybe a case to keep in the back of our heads moving forward. Okay. There is, of course, a harder answer, which is certainly better in capital N, but not necessarily better in little n. And in this particular case, it's a result of which basically says there's an algorithm that computes a value m that is no more than one-fifth, or sorry, one 5% of the true value of BML1. It's always strictly equal to greater than or equal to the true value. And furthermore, the number of operations to compute this value m is c little n, capital N log n, which of course is much nicer than n squared. But on the other hand, the constant is, the dimension is much worse. It's something like n to the n. Okay. And so, this second algorithm is of course quite useful then when your dimension is far less than the number of points, that is to say, low dimension, large number of points. Right? Okay. So, how does this work? Well, just briefly. The idea is not a mix of the ideas we've already seen. The idea of this n log n algorithm is to use a modified version of the well separated pair decomposition, originally invented by Kalman and Subraju, but which the modified version is this one introduced by Charlie Fefferman and Boaz Alarfag in 2009. And that since it computes, and so basically the sort of gist of that is indicated by this picture here. Right, so here are some points in R2. We want to find a well-separated pair decomposition of these points. This is what that would look like for a certain choice of parameter associated to the algorithm. But you know, what makes this really work is, again, the fact that this is sort of decomposing the space of pairs of points in a multi-scale fashion. Right? So basically, if two circles are connected by a line, that is one of the well-separated pairs in the well-separated. So we see that basically there's sort of this sort of multi-scale nature to the pairs of sets, which are in the well-separated pair. This is what allows us to get this. incidentally, the same ideas would allow you to compute potential energies in particle physics and like and so this actually did not do this. This was from a website I found by a guy named Alex Mutal, I think I was a research scientist. So anyway, one of the key points of this is that it computes, this algorithm computes gamma 1 to within a dimensionless constant, which is quite nice. And since gamma 1 gives you the minimum value of the grad f, it computes the minimum value of the grad f, which is a related function to a dimensionless constant, using only O of capital M log n. So now, of course, we sort of answer the question about how small can we make lip grad f when we're given ingredients to see how we compute it. Now we want to go back to the problem when we're not given ingredients, we're only given the function values. And we want to ask the question, how small can we make lip grad f for the interpolation problem when we're given only the function values? Right? So the cards we make sure we have in the back of our mind, right? And now we just have the points and the colors that is to say the function values, but no arrows, so no gradients, right? And so actually, Erwan in the same paper also gave the solution to this, which is to say that the smallest possible value of the graph f is this function of gamma 1, which not only depends on the variables e and the function values f, but which is written as the infimum of the previous function gamma 1 over all possible choices of the gradients. Okay? So now the question is, well, how do we compute this? This is, of course, harder, right? Because it's not just the computing n squared values, it's computing n squared values that every, you know, and then minimizing them over all possible choices. Little n times capital N values, which is the number of degrees of freedom that you have. So one possible answer is to use algorithms for convex optimization. This is what Dario and Frederick and I did in our paper. The complexity guarantees are not as nice as for the gradient problem, but let's see what they are. Okay, so we want to compute the optimal value of lip grad f when we're not given the gradients. It's given by this. And additionally, as we'll see, we want to return the gradients at the points e in our initial data set, such that if we evaluate gamma 1 at e, f, and e f star, we get back the optimal value for the problem without the gradients. And this will be useful down the line for when we want to compute the interpolating function capital N. So this is indeed an optimization problem of the little n times capital N variables, right? Because associated to each of our capital N points, we need to specify a gradient in little rn. And so the idea that we pursued was to formulate an equivalent optimization problem up to dimensionless constants, which is convex, and is in terms of self-concordant, so-called self-concordant functions, the reason for which is that because there are theoretical guarantees associated to this class of functions for certain types of
functions. Matt, what does self-concordant mean? Maybe many of us don't know what certain is.
Maybe I can tell you online or after.
Okay.
It's not terribly hard, but you haven't actually screwed up with that.
Okay.
But it's without writing down the definition, basically it's a certain class of functions for which when you have a convex optimization problem in terms of this class of functions, and you try to solve this with a Newton method, with Newton's method, excuse me, you can get guarantees in terms of the number of steps and the cost of the step. Okay. So that's, yes.
So what do you mean by dimensionless constants?
Oh, I just mean they don't depend on the little n.
Okay.
So basically, the cost of the algorithm is going to be this. It's going to be the number, so we're going to use a Newton method, and the cost of the algorithm will be the number of Newton steps we need to get down to a desired tolerance times the cost of each Newton step. And then there's actually another thing hidden in the cost, which is not generally addressed theoretically, which unfortunately we do not address either, which is the cost of the line search, which is basically to say each step and your descent algorithm, you definitely have to specify the direction you want to descend. send. You also have to specify the magnitude of that direction domain. And that's what the line search is doing. Generally, this is considered sort of a very small cost that is not addressed. But I actually cannot say for sure that it's not large in this particular case. So anyway, here's what we can say. So let epsilon, script epsilon, be greater than 0. This is going to be our tolerance. Then there is an algorithm that computes a value of m that is sort of within the same constant factor of 20 of the true of the best value gamma 1, but with an additive error, right? So it is not proportional, it's just an additive error. And then computes the gradients at the specified points b such that gamma 1 of b of f of b m is 1. And the complexity of this algorithm is the cost to set up the optimization problem, which I did not specify, but which is based upon the well-suffered compared decomposition. The number of Newton steps, which is then this, it's the root of n log n times the log of n over epsilon. The well-suffered compared decomposition gives an improvement here over the more naive implementation, in which case the number of Newton steps would be n. This n log n root would be just n log n over epsilon. And then the cost per Newton step, and this is sort of where the guarantee is less nice, is OM cubed. So we have to invert a matrix. And the matrix has an order of capital M, and since the inversion is of the order of M cubed. But it's sparse because of the well-suffered impaired decomposition. And I have a conjecture based on some other papers which give guarantees for other types of sparse problems that maybe you can get it down to ON 3/2. Which would not be too bad. That would be basically an ON squared algorithm for computing the best value of gamma 1 to within some error epsilon up to a dimensionless constant. Plus some law factors. But as it stands, it's empty. And then I should also say there's the line search, which is just completely unaddressed. As far as I know, you don't have to work that out from scratch. I really don't know. Okay, so that's that. Okay, so where are we at? So regardless of whether you started with the function value problem, that is to say, you're only given function values with no gradients, or the function value plus gradients problem, that is to say, easier to two, right? You're given function values and gradients. We now have the following. That is to say, we have points, we have function values, and we have gradients, regardless of which one we started with, because, well, if we started with gradients, we still have gradients. And if we didn't start with gradients, well, we just solved for them. We just solved for them with our convex optimization algorithm. And additionally, we have a target value of m, for which we have like the function f in C1 of Rn that interpolates the above data and has a Lipschitz constant of its gradient. M can be gamma 1 exactly, or it can be gamma 1, say, up to a constant factor. So now we need to compute the interpolating function f and see what we're going to we're going to use the query model, which we heard about previously this week, which consists of one-time work to set up sort of the function, and then query work, which basically in which the user specifies an arbitrary x and rn, and the computer returns f of x and the gradient of f of x in this particular case. And this is sort of repeated as many times as you can. Okay, so for the one-time work, we're going to use basically the proof of Wells from 1973, which is in fact in Sharpe. It's interesting to think about Monday's talk in the afternoon in terms of algorithms, but well, we have not done that. And so like other algorithms we have seen this week, it is based on decomposition of Rn. But unlike Clutter-Zingen decompositions, it is not multi-scale. And so this has pros and cons associated to it. The pro is that it's going to be intricate enough that if we specify a feasible value of m, then we'll be able to compute an interpolating function f in C1 over n. It has exactly the Lipschitz constant of its gradient with no loss whatsoever. So that's, of course, the very nice part. In particular, if m is gamma 1, then f will achieve the best possible value of the Lipschitz. On the other hand, because it is not multi-scale, There's going to be far more sets in this decomposition than there are cubes in the sequence. And our worst case complexity guarantees are going to be really, really bad, except in low dimensions. And then again, maybe this is not too bad, because as we said before, sort of low dimensions and large numbers of points is sort of where our algorithms in particular are things. So anyway, here's sort of the picture to indicate why it makes sense. So it's a little, well, it's not, it's the same as 3D, but I should clarify that the points here are the points in E. Actually, the points in E here have been erased, unfortunately, but there's about the same number of points in E, the original E here, instead of row over here. And so here's sort of one, you know, sort of the added cubic decomposition of the space, which may be a CZ decomposition. Here's the Wells decomposition, right? You can just see it today. All the sort of different sets are about the same size. Some are narrower than others, certainly, but you know, there's certainly not the sort of power of the whole sort of decomposition associated with it. And so intuitively, you also get the feel that there's something called a lot more sets in the decomposition. On the other hand, the patterns are quite nice, so it's sort of a nice picture versus. Okay, so to compute the Wells decomposition, we're going to use tools from computational geometry, namely something called a power diagram, something called the Lamm triangulation, and an algorithm for computing convex walls. So let me explain what these things are, and then we'll get back to Wells. Okay, so a power diagram is just a generalization of a four-way diagram, in which to each point in your set, you associate a weight function W. Okay? So let our set be Z, intentionally not using E for reasons we'll see later. So let Z be this set of that points Zi and R and N, and we just associate to each point Zi the weight W. Zi. And the power function of Zi is the same here. It basically computes the distance squared from Zi to any point X and Rn, but then subtracts off the weight. Okay, so if the weight is zero, of course this is just the Euclidean distance squared. Okay. And the power cell of Zi is this thing here, which is basically all the points x and rn, such that the power from x to zi is less than or equal to the power from x to zj for all j not equal to I. Okay. So basically, it's all points x and rn that are closer to zi than they are to zj, but according to the power function, right? And again, if the weights were all zero, then it would just be closer to standard Euclidean sense. Okay. So these are n-dimensional sets when they're not empty. And the faces of the power cell correspond to lower dimensional components of the boundary of the cell. Okay, so I'll sort of clarify this not rigorously, but with the picture. And the power diagram of Z, we're going to denote PD of Z. We're going to take it to consist of these n-dimensional cells in addition to all these different faces of dimension 0, 1, 2, up to n minus 1. Okay. So let me just show you. So the red is the power diagram, the blue are the points of Z. Okay, so it looks pretty much like the four-way diagram, except maybe you can infer where it's not going to be. Actually, this is so long ago, I can't remember it. But yeah, so basically it looks like the four-way diagram is from the point. And basically the cells, right, are these planar regions enclosed by the red lines. Right? You notice some of them, they're all two-dimensional, you'll notice some of them and then the faces correspond to the lower dimensional components, right? So the lines, right? The lines are faces, but also the red dots are faces. Okay? So it's not unlike what's different than the CW complex, which I call it. Okay, so there then is an associated dual diagram associated to the power diagram, which is this the Lamm triangle. Okay, so this is the geometric dual of the power diagram. I'm not going to write down precisely what that means, but basically what you're doing is, for each j-dimensional face or cell of the power diagram, you're associating to it an n minus j-dimensional face or cell of a triangulation. It has this property of being orthogonal, and basically which sort of reverses and so if a face in the power cell was contained in a large larger phase or cell of the power diagram, the triangulation reverses the same. Okay, so basically the blue is what you're seeing here. You'll also notice that the original blue points in Z are the same sort of corners here of the triangulation. Okay, so here's a fun fact. You can compute the triangulation, and hence the power diagram, by just computing a convex hull in one dimension. Okay. So how does that work? When you take your point Z, and you map it into Rn plus 1 via this map lambda, which basically keeps the first n coordinates the same, and then appends an n plus first coordinate, which consists of zi squared minus w of zi. Remember, this is the power associated with the points of zi. We then compute the convex hull of lambda z, called the same comp of lambda z. And then we orthogonally project the lower hull of the convex hull of lambda z back onto Rn. And this gives you exactly the triangulation. And the lower hull, what we mean by the lower hull, is all points on the convex hull that you can see from negative infinity into n plus first coordinate. So in other words, you don't have to pass through the hull to see. And so the upshot of this is you just, quote unquote, need to compute a convex hull of capital N points in n plus Rn plus 1. The justice it quotes because the worst case complexity of this computation is not so good as an understated number. It's capital N to the little n divided by 2, and this is the ceiling plus n, capital N log n for good measure. So this is, of course, quite bad in high dimensions. There's sort of no way around that. There are some sort of caveats and provisos. Of course, when the dimension is not too big, this is not so bad. So for example, if n is less than or equal to 4, right, this would be like n squared. You sort of see how like n squared is maybe some optimal, or not optimal, but, you know, getting sort of in the range of sort of things we can sort of compute with in terms of computing the ML1. I will also say that generically, that is to say, if your points are sampled from some nice distribution, like maybe uniform distribution or something like that, then computing them generically, the convex hull will very, very, very rarely achieve this worst case bound, and in fact, the average case bound is significantly. Right now what it is, but it's actually somewhere on the order of like n log n, a lot of log n's. So there's sort of the potential for sort of the sort of average case guarantees maybe not so bad, but certainly the worst case here in electrons. In high dimension in particular. Okay, so anyway. Here's how that procedure works in pictures. Here are our points, here are the lifted points, here's the convex hull of the lifted points. Here's the lower hull of the convex hull of the lifted points. Here's this projection back on R2. And this is, sure enough, the Delaunay triangulation. Okay. So now let's describe the Wells decomposition as an algorithm. So recall we have points E, function values F, gradients E, F, and value M for which we want the M for the interpolating function. So this is why I did Z before. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to shift the points E, we're going to call these E tilde, or X tilde. We're going to basically shift them by the gradient associated to the point divided by the target value M for the coefficients constant. Okay. We're then going to compute the power diagram for the Delaunay triangulation of E tilde with a rate function W, which is in terms of the specified function and gradient information, as well as the target value M. And we're then going to use, say, our algorithm for computing the convex hull in Rn plus 1 to do this. And we're then going to let S be a face or cell of the power diagram. In red, we're going to let S prime be the dual face or cell in blue of the triangulation. Again, remark that if the dimension of S is J, then the dimension of S prime is N minus J. And really what this means is that the affine spaces containing S and S prime are orthogonal. Then we define the following n-dimensional set, TS, which which is basically you take any point in S, you can add it to any point in S prime, divide by 2, and this defines this n-dimensional set. The collection of all of these over all different bases and cells forms this little decomposition. Okay. And so this is what, so this is of course somewhat mysterious on the surface, and I'm happy to clarify it for you, but I didn't say it first. So here's what it is in practice, right? So in red we have a more complex power diagram from before. In blue we have the associated dual triangulation. And so again, what you're going to do is you're going to find for each of these faces in the power diagram its associated dual face in the triangulation. So this is, for example, right here. This red face is dual to this blue one because I can see the orthogonal, and so on and so forth. What you're going to do is you're going to compute this new set TS out of them. Okay. And this is what you're going to put. This is the picture we saw. Okay. So this is the decomposition of this case. Okay, so we've seen how to compute this. And now that we have this decomposition in hand, what's left to do is to define the function capital F. This is going to be done in terms of local functions or local interpolating functions, each of which is defined on one of these sets TS. And they're defined as such, and actually there's some terms in here which I have not defined, and I'm going to say we can compute them. So one is this DS of XS. This is, so X sub S is a special point that you have to compute for each of these sets TS. It can be done. Then you have to compute this DS of that point. This can also be done. And once you do that, then when you get a new point X, you realize it's a TS. You know, you can write it as a Z on a power diagram of S, a Z prime in a triangulation, as a Z in the base S of the power diagram of E tilde, a Z prime in the base S prime of the triangulation of E tilde. And this is what you compute the function to be on the set. Also, you get this nice simple formula for the gradient of these local functions on the set. And basically, the key point is that these formulas plus the sort of intricate nature of these sets TS allow you to define these local interpolating functions that fit together. There's no partition of unity required. And so this allows us well to construct a global interpolating function with exactly the specified value of the graph. And so in particular, right? So the function f defined as such, basically, whenever x is in TS, you evaluate f as s of x. It's well defined. These sets overlap on a set of measure 0, but they do overlap, but they agree. The functions agree on the overlap. And furthermore, f is in C11, it's Lipschitz constant gradient, it's a specified value, and it interpolates the even and the even. So then, what is left to do is, of course, the computational cost, right? So, in our paper, we estimated a horrible one-time work of O(n) to the little n plus 2. This is almost certainly too pessimistic. It is due to some very, very loose and just frankly bad counting in one slot. So I think the most likely correct operation count should be the cost of computing the complex one. Right? It should be O of n to the little n over 2 plus n. This is indeed like the number of cases is basically this, right? So the worst case. So I would think this should. And then for the queries, we can encode the set TS by storing a matrix AS and the vector BS such that if X is in TS, then basically AS applied to X is less than or equal to B sub S. Okay? And so then basically given an X and RF, we need to figure out which sets TS contain, figure out which of these sets TS contains X. So basically we just have to check these inequalities. Of course, you could have a lot of things you don't necessarily want to check them all. And so you can build basically a type of binary tree over all of this collection of sets that empirically is often balanced, which, if it is balanced, yields a query time of O log n, which is great. But proving that it's always balanced is either very hard or impossible in a really natural rich. So we didn't. But actually, this really works quite well. And so anyway, when you do all that together, this is like the entry. Right? So there is data underneath this function. dimension values. They're solved for gradients. We specify the dimension for which in this particular picture. And each of the different color portions corresponds to one of these different global interpolating functions, f sub s, defined by the associated sub t sub s. You can see how they fit together by this. In R2, it runs. Okay. So, in the remaining time, which is 15 minutes, I'm going to discuss now the regression problem. Okay. This is basically what we have in mind here is noisy data, as we mentioned at the beginning of the talk. Now I'm going to make it a little bit more precise. So we're going to consider now a function little f, which is not just defined on the set E, but which is in fact defined on the closed unit ball of n dimensions, which will denote by p. Okay. And so basically in this section of the talk, we're going to replace Rm with pm. Okay. And the reason for that is going to be a compact space. And so we're going to observe that n, we're applying noisy values of n, which consists of the function, this underlying function f, evaluated with xi, plus an epsilon I, where the xi are sampled iid from some probability distribution p sub x, supported on the n-dimensional unit ball. And the epsilon I are iid normally distributed in the variables with mean zero and variance sigma squared. Okay. So this is sort of a very standard model in statistical learning theory. And so in particular, we're going to be given data consisting of points in Rn, xi, associated noisy values, yi, or capital N of them, and they're going to be sampled from this joint distribution, which we're just going to call P, which consists of P of x cross P of y given x, right? Where, so basically, which comes from this model, where P of y given x, right, is sampled. This plus this sample from the normal distribution centered at f of x, which is given with variance sigma squared. Okay, so, what we want to do, we want to fit our noisy data, right, which is this, with some, function, capital F sub n to clearly indicate the number of points that we have from C11 of Pn. Okay. And so to do so, we would like to solve the following optimization problem. Okay. We would like to basically find the argon theorem over all candidate functions in C11 of Pn over this thing, right? Remember this thing from the beginning of the talk. This is what we call the empirical risk. This is the squared loss, the average squared loss between the function values of our function and the values we're given, subject to the constraint that the Lipschitz constant of the gradient of f is less than equal to n, right? And so you may recall at the beginning of the talk we wrote this as follows: fn is the rn of f over c11n of bn of rn hat of f, where cn11 bn is all c11 functions of the ball such that the Lipschitz constant is equal to n. And Rn hat f is the empirical risk, which I emphasize on capital N terms here, so that later we can see how this behaves as N groups. Okay, so this is what we want to do. Okay. So let's see how far we can go. Okay, so I'm just restating what we want to do again here at the top. So we're going to need to answer these two fundamental questions. Given the data and a value for n, right, this is like a parameter now, how do we compute fn? And then we might also like the following. Because now, right, the data actually comes from some underlying function f, little f, right? It's not the little f that's just values on e, it's really the little f is defined on all of bn, right? And so we would like to be able to select m, this parameter, to depend on n, the number of points we're given, in such a way such that fn converges to f in some suitable sense, which I'll make more precise, as n goes to infinity. we'd like some consistency between our empirical risk minimizer FN and the true underlying function of that, right? So people in statistical learning theory, machine learning theory, are very interested in this type of thing because very rarely do they think that data is just data and there's no underlying process involved in it, right? There's usually always something underlying generating it, and they want it to model content, right? So this is sort of the type of guarantee that in this idealized scenario, when you get an infinite number of data points, your algorithm will at least behave as you would hope it would, which is the stable learning model. So let's first look at this book, sorry. Let's look at this first problem. First question first, right? So just how are we going to compute this, right? Okay, so recall, right, once again, this is the optimization problem we're interested in, right? The RPFIMA, the overall efficacy of the MPN, the empirical risks of the genetic solutions, right? We're going to replace this problem with this optimization problem, right? Recall that E is just a set of points xi, right? We're going to look for basically function values and gradients that minimize, so we take the RPFIMA over all candidate function values on the set E, all candidate gradients on the set E, we're going to minimize the empirical risk, that is to say, the average squared loss of these function values relative to the given noisy values, subject to what constraint, well, the constraint given by the gradient, which is the gamma 1 of E of F tilde and D of tilde should be less than or equal to M. And then, once we have solved this optimization problem, right, we're going to compute an interpolating function using all the formulas we're going to discuss, Fn and C11 of Bn for the data E, Fn star, D of n star, and with Lipschitz constant of per unit of n specified as Mn, which is n, which really is the gamma 1 of E of n. And so if you sort of think about these two things, you would realize that they are equivalent to this. This is reasonable because of what we just discussed. Okay, so now we need to solve this out. Underlying function C1-Lamarckian. So in particular, the y is noisy realizations of f of xi for normally distributed random I of random variables. And so as I mentioned previously, we want to know under what circumstances f of n converges to f, but then goes to infinity in some suitable sense. And so to do so, we're going to relate this empirical risk, L, which I forgot the n, to the true risk, R of f. And what is the true risk? Well, the true risk is basically this quantity, but taken over the entire unit ball according to the distribution. Okay. We sample x and y from this distribution, we compute the expectation over all the entire probability space. This is the true risk, right? So this is basically, if you had access to all the possible data out there, this is the true risk. This is sort of the thing you would want to minimize, right? But of course, in practice, you don't have all the data out there. That's an infinite amount of data. You don't have a finite amount of data. So you minimize the empirical risk. So what you would like to know, though, is your empirical risk a good proxy for your true risk? And in particular, you would like to do something like this. You would like to bound the supremum over all candidate functions f of the difference between the empirical risk and the true risk. Okay, with high probability. So we have the empirical risk, we have the true risk. We want to know that the empirical risk is a good proxy for the true risk. There's a bit of a problem, which is a technical point, which is that we have to replace C1 with 1 of Bn with what we call bold C1 1 of Bn, which we equip with a norm and not a semi-norm. And this is the norm. And so we're going to have to amend sort of everything I just said. So we're going to amend the goal, right? The goal is now going to be a bold CM1. The model is going to be, at least for the next few slides, a little f and bold CM1. We'll come back to this in a few slides and then I will go ahead. So what can we do though with this new space? We can do the following. Let little n tilde be the maximum of the dimension little n in 5. Set your capital M to depend on big N as big N to the 1 over 2 to the little n tilde. Then for any delta between 0 and 1, the probability that the supremum over all candidate functions in our bold C1-1 space with norm less than or equal to M sub little n. The supremum over all of them of the difference between the empirical risk and the true risk is less than the sum epsilon of n. So the probability of this being true is large. That's basically what this says. We can make delta as close to zero as we like, and we can see that this is going to sort of rapidly decrease as capital N gets bigger. And this should be a script E epsilon. Script E epsilon n is monotonic increasing, so that is to say, the bound is getting better and better for large enough n, and the probability is also getting better and better for large enough n. And in fact, it's going to zero as n goes to infinity, and in particular, the supremum norm on the difference, or supremum absolute value on the difference between these two values, will converge to zero almost surely. In other words, indeed, our empirical risk is a good proxy for the true risk. Okay. So long as we have two samples, we should just need us. And so then, with that, right, you can prove the following theorem, which is let me just sort of touch on this piece, right? So basically, we sort of redefine the empirical risk minimizer now for our new space, which is the old C1-1. And basically using the fact that the empirical risk is a good proxy for the true risk, you can basically prove another high probability result. And in this case, it's saying that the empirical risk minimizer, that is the thing we're solving for, right, will converge to the underlying model, little f of x, almost surely as f goes to infinity. So let's get this. So in other words, consistent estimate. Okay, so there's this point about old tumbling, not old tumbling. Suffice it to say that there's some results in the paper which sort of address this and say that, well, it's happening. I'm just going to skip that out of time. Here are some experiments which basically show that here's the underlying F, here's the empirical risk minimizer Fn for increasing capital N. As you can see, it's visually convergent to the underlying model. Here's a more quantitative thing showing the error between F of the empirical risk minimizer and the underlying model, so it's increasing. And so this should be again. To conclude, we can both interpolate noiseless data, we can compute regressions of noisy data using functions in C1 of Rn or Bn, which directly improve the smoothness of F. This framework can be valuable for problems where there is an explicit smoothness prior to our data. Right? So, for example, thinking of problems in physics, maybe particle physics, where you have maybe F of X corresponds to energies, and then you have forces, right? Maybe you have some knowledge of how these energies and forces should behave, maybe C1 or C2 or something like that is a good model. On the other hand, as we've seen, there's sort of many open questions, including better runtime balance, maybe average runtime guarantee is more efficient or approximate. Approximate interpolation is based on both the composition, not exact interpolation, which are sort of very, very costly, but for which you can do sort of maybe approximate power diagrams, investigating higher order smoothness possible, of course, and certain benefit risk of dimensionality if possible. So anyway, with that.
Questions? Well, if not, then thank the speaker again. Okay, so now we have a coffee break, informal discussions, and we are meeting tonight for the banquet at 6:30 at the Clay Pit restaurant. And I'll just give you the directions. It's one block south and one block west of the hotel. At the Hampton Inn. And it's on the campus map marked as R1. So we'll meet there at 6:30.
Yeah, actually, you can bring this to the PDF. You can bring this to the PDF. Just fits quite out of context. Just think about it.